All right. So, Dave, things are about to look a little different around this Civilizations podcast now, aren't they?
A little.
We are finally leaving the scramble. I mean, we sort of took a step away from the scramble for Africa, and now we're leaving the scramble altogether. And we're heading back to Europe. My goodness.
Well, we will go elsewhere.
We certainly will. We certainly will. They didn't. I mean, I think you can make a case that this was a European war, World War One. But they did call it World War One, and so we're gonna have to take that world part seriously, because that's what we do. So just to give listeners an idea, we did Civilization, in case you're just joining us now, we did Civilizations, which is, I don't know, something like 50 episodes where we go from 1500 to 1900. Oh, no, I guess to 1500 to the early 1800s, let's say, mid 1800s. Then we did Scramble for Africa, where we go basically all the way to the beginning of the 20th century with the Scramble for Africa as the theme. And now we're starting the 20th century. And the way that I see it, and we could end up changing direction or whatever, but the way I see it is these are going to be several series. There'll be a series about World War One, there'll be a series about World War Two. And then there'll be a series, which I'm thinking will be, the theme will be decolonization. So it'll be, the decolonization of India, the decolonization in Africa, all the kind of decolonizations, which some people call the Cold War, right? That would be another way to approach it. But I think the main thing to pay attention to, and it's also nice because we did the Scramble for Africa, so it'll be nice to go country by country, as they become independent countries, which is, sort of exciting. There are bad news stories for sure, but that's overall, I contend that decolonization is a good news story. But each one of these is going to be really, really big. We did 30 some for Scramble for Africa and 50 some for Civilizations, but we're looking at World War One alone, and we haven't start you we've mapped out what we want to do for pre-World War One, the causes of World War One, and where we've got a plan for about 22 or so episodes before the first shot is even fired. Well, that's not true. There are lots of shots being fired before 1914, but before we even really start the war, before the trenches and before, the Belgium is crossed and all that, we have 22 episodes.
Yeah,
So
22 for now.
for now. And there'll probably
The
be
number
20,
may be adjusted.
there'll probably be A's, B's, and C's. So I'm gonna go, let's go back to your class. So I took your grade 13 Modern Western Civilization class in Mississauga, Ontario, I believe in 1994. And so we were covering, all the stuff we covered so far. We did a lot. I remember you t doing a lot on the French Revolution, a lot of these things that we've covered, and we've tried to fill all the gaps that you didn't get to cover. But I do also remember World War One being a big deal, the causes of World War One. Why don't you talk first of all about how you cover it in as a t how you used to cover it as a high school subject. Why, what you wanted students to get out of it, what you want as takeaways, what the limitations are of trying to teach it as a high school subject.
Sure. Well, just a reminder, in Ontario, the only history course that is compulsory is grade 10 Canadian history, which many students avoid by taking it in summer school, get it over quickly. Sorry.
Did you ever teach it at summer school or?
Oh God, no.
No.
No. No.
I guess teachers do that when they, you know, are bachelors or need extra money or
something. Some people do it regularly. I'm not sure I understand why, but they do. Yeah, so if grade 10 history is the only time that these students are going to get any history, and since Canadian history, you know, Canada and the Great War, or Canada and World War II, they're pretty big moments in Canadian history. But it's rather odd to say, all right, so then our boys went off to fight in the Great War. If you have no explanation of what the heck is going on, what is this Great War? How did it start? Why are we involved?
It's true. Like at the Faculty of Forestry at the University of Toronto, where I went, did my, you know, my graduate degrees, they have a memorial to like the men of the Faculty of Forestry that died in World War One. I'm pretty sure it's World War One. And I don't think they have even a World War II memorial there. I don't remember. So there's like a really special Canada World War One thing in Canadian culture. I'm not sure if that is true in the US or in the UK, but it does seem to have a bigger resonance, at least in Anglo Canada. Yeah.
Well, you'll see that the Americans joined the war late in 1917.
Right.
So Canadians were involved from day one.
Right.
And the population was fairly small at the time. And some 600,000 Canadian troops served.
And it was another one of those contentious issues between Anglo and French.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, conscription and all of that. But it was a pretty... at the same time as it was traumatic, it was a unifying experience for Canadians. It was the first time that they had fought basically as Canadians rather than, you know, separate parts of the British Empire. So you had, you know, young men from the prairies with young men from the Maritimes and from Central Canada all serving together. And all identified by the maple leaf on their uniforms.
And I guess there were, you know, despite this being like a very low point in terms of the state's treatment of Indigenous people, there were a lot of Indigenous troops, right?
And quite a few
veterans coming back and, you know, demand and or the organizing. I think we talked about that in our episodes on Canada, our three-parter on Canada and civilizations, yeah. Where a lot of, like, I think this was the case for Black soldiers, Canadians and Americans as well, where they would, you know, they veterans had a harder time accepting, you know, racism upon their return.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a huge event in Canadian history. With multiple ramifications. Also, over the years, it's grown to be a bigger part of the curriculum because they keep changing the curriculum. So when I started teaching, basically you did Canadian history from Confederation. So you start in 1867. After you've done your unit on government and your unit on law, so your first month or more of school, you're actually teaching them what is now in the civics course. So government and law. So they changed the curriculum and decided to start in 1900. All because Prime Minister Wilfrid Laurier made a statement that the 19th century had belonged to Britain, but the 20th century was going to belong to Canada. So for that reason, they said,
is that, grade 10, is that Laurier? Who was that?
Yeah, Laurier.
Yeah, right.
So on the basis of that silly quotation, we're going to start in 1900. So right in the middle of the Boer War.
Yeah.
Right? So, do I include that?
Just pick a battle, you know? Drop them in the middle of the battle or something. Drop them in the middle of an internment camp and be like, so here we are. History has begun.
Yeah. Well, and it's a little disorienting, obviously, but it also assumes we were assured that in elementary school up to grade 8, the students would have been taught history up to 1900. So don't worry about all that stuff. It'll be covered in elementary school. Well, if you know anything about elementary school in Ontario, they're under many of the same pressures as the secondary schools. So the curriculum that counts is English and math. And, you know, obviously subjects like history are taught when you have time. Also, a lot of the teachers in elementary schools aren't history specialists. So their coverage of the material could be, you know, cursory, could be a little hands off. You have no idea. So if you take
it, necessarily their subject, right?
Right. Well, yeah, the same as if I was teaching the science components, right? In any case, if you take a survey of your grade 10 class on the first day, so how many of you know what Confederation is? You might get 3 or 4 who have an idea what that is. And the rest just look at you like, hey, man, I'm not from here. So, and that's another thing, too, right? You're also teaching quite a few ESL students, recent immigrants. You just can't assume that everybody knows. So, regardless of what the curriculum says, you have to go back and do a review of, okay, so here's how we, you know, officially became a country, and here's how we got along with Britain, and here's why we're in the Boer War. And well, they changed the curriculum again, and the new title is Canada Since World War One.
It
led to a lot of raised hands among the teachers. Wait a sec. When you say since, do you mean starting with World War One or after World War
One? No, after. So clearly it's 1919 or whatever, right?
Okay, you could be forgiven for thinking that, but either way, when you keep shortening the time period that we're covering, it adds more emphasis to what you are doing. So World War Two gets to be a bigger deal.
Yes, yes.
Or World War One becomes a bigger deal. So between that and the fact that this might be their only history course, you know, we figured it behooved us to do World War One justice, including.
But I didn't. I wasn't even in that class. So no. I had a different teacher for grade one. I'm grade one, grade 10.
Right.
I also had a different teacher for grade one.
Hopefully.
But yeah, the teacher I had for grade 10 history was a very law kind of oriented teacher. We won't mention him. But you did, I mean, I'd say the approach to World War One that we're going to take here takes more from your grade 13, you know, I guess Western Civilization class.
Yeah, yeah.
So
part of the approach that works in grade 10 is going to work in grade 12 or 13 as well.
Okay.
So I guess I'm repeating the intro to our very first series, but you kind of do a Venn diagram of, okay, what is important that they should know? What is fun or interesting that they will enjoy, and then you try to incorporate those elements.
Right.
And you also try to make it so that they can understand it.
Yeah, I mean, it is a weird one too, because it's like World War II, you have the Nazis, and you can just sort of say like the Nazis, there's a rise of Nazism and everybody had to figure out what to do about it, which isn't true. That's not exactly what happened. But with World War One, it really is kind of, it's very complex, right? Yeah. It's a very complex number of reasons, the number of variables, the number of inputs that were happening. You know, we have the scramble for Africa. So I feel like, In a sense, you know, we talked about Lenin and his book about imperialism, and Du Bois, The African Roots of War. So in a way, like both of those books and a lot of, you could make the case that the entire Scramble for Africa series was a series on the causes of World War One.
Yeah.
You have these colonial powers running around and they finally have taken everything. So now they have to fight each other.
Yeah, so there's a tendency to look at World War II as good versus evil.
Yeah, exactly.
And unfortunately, there's a similar tendency with World War I.
Right, which doesn't. It's definitely evil versus evil in World War I, from my perspective, at least.
Yeah, but you have to, you are, of course, fighting against a lot of perceptions.
Yeah.
On Remembrance Day, November 11th, the date that World War I ended.
Which is called Remembrance Day in Canada, but I don't think it's...
No, called... it's not elsewhere.
Yeah, it's called
Americans call it Veterans Day?
Veterans Day, I think, yeah.
Okay, so in Canada, it is observed by, of course, playing taps over the morning announcements, but also by the wearing of poppies. So the poppy is a flower that grew all over Flanders, where most of the Canadian troops were stationed and fighting and dying, of course. So the poppy became a symbol, and in a poem by McCrae, in Flanders fields, the poppies grow between the crosses row on row. So you're thinking of World War I cemeteries, these flowers. So to remember the fallen soldiers, you wear a poppy on your lapel.
But it's like super militarist, that poem, right? Because he's saying,
yeah. To you from failing hands, we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. So we went and died. Now it's your turn.
Yeah, and, right.
Yeah, so you're looking at your students and thinking, oh, I hope you don't catch.
I hope you don't get the message I'm teaching you here.
Yeah, I would much rather you read Wilfred Owen, Dulce et Decorum Est. Do you remember that?
Yeah. I think, I don't know whether that was you or, but somebody.
Yeah, it was, I think. So that, Dulce et Decorum Est is how sweet and proper it is. And the next line is to die for your country.
Yeah.
But Owen shows a guy who's been poisoned in a gas attack and is basically coughing his lungs out and dying in the back of a cart.
Oh, you know what? That might have been in that book. We had a little anti-war book to read in our grade 10 or grade 11 like English literature.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think it was a Canadian author about a Canadian guy who goes to World War I and, you know, doesn't have a good time of it. He gets assaulted by his comrades at the end.
Okay.
I think it's just called The Wars or something. Is that right?
Timothy Findlay.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so here's the thing. You can find war poets who are basically next generation Kiplings, right?
Yeah.
Pro-empire, exactly. Pro-war, sacrifice for your country, and all that kind of stuff. And then you can find other guys who are describing the reality and are cursing the clergymen and the parents and the teachers who told them that this would be a good idea, that they should go off and serve in the war and get, you know.
Yeah, which is why when we get into the consequences of World War I, some pretty big changes happen as consequences of World War I.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's a tendency with all of our World War I memorials, with all of our Remembrance Day ceremonies, to unquestioningly believe that these guys were fighting on the side of good and right. And yeah, you have to point that out to students that
a bit of a stretch.
Canadians did bad things in the war, just like everybody else. Yeah. And in many cases, did not know why they were there.
Yeah,
even British soldiers didn't know why they were there. There's a famous episode from 1915 where British soldiers in the trenches were singing, and they were singing, "Why are we fighting?"
And I mean the fraternizing, right? Like all the Christmas.
Yeah. We'll get to those stories because they are really fascinating. So yeah, you have to remind your students at several stages. Okay, this isn't good versus evil.
Yeah,
we are not the good guys.
Yeah,
and I don't want to, insult the memory of the fallen, but I don't want to turn them into saints either because they weren't.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about like a period of racial ideology of, you know, just the scramble for Africa, like we talked about the stuff they were doing to Africans at this time.
Well, two of my grandfather's brothers served in World War II. Different war, but I think it's illustrative of what I'm trying to say. So, of course, as a kid, I'm really curious, and I want to talk to my great uncles and say, like, what happened? You know, where were you? So one of them was a medical officer who served in Britain, and the other was an engineer who actually landed on the Normandy beaches on D-Day. So I asked them, why did you join up?
Right.
And they both had the same answer. Well, you know, king and country, everybody was going.
Everybody was going.
You know? And I'm saying, what about Hitler? Ah, we didn't know all that much about him.
Who?
Yeah, they didn't know about concentration camps. They didn't know about mass murders. They didn't know those things.
But that's like not not like daily press coverage in Canada or the U.S., right?
It's only
after the liberation of the camps that they even like. You know, the Soviets published all this stuff. And,
well, the British government knew during the war. They simply didn't publish the information because, like the American Civil War, they didn't want to turn it into a war to save the Jews.
Yeah, right.
Just like we don't want the Civil War to be about freeing the slaves, right?
Exactly.
So we're going to take a different tack on this. And it's a bit of a fine line. So you go with... Let's organize this material for you. The causes of World War I, plural, obviously. There are many, many causes, and no single one started it. And you divide them into distant and immediate causes.
Right.
So the distant is the buildup of tensions, the buildup of rivalries and distrust and fear and hatred and all of that stuff. And you compare it to a barrel of gunpowder.
Right.
So a barrel of gunpowder is obviously a dangerous thing to have around, but it doesn't explode by itself.
Yeah.
You need an immediate cause, which would be like the spark or the match. Now, again, an immediate cause by itself doesn't start a war. Striking a match does not cause an explosion. So you need both. You need the barrel of gunpowder and the spark or the match.
And then it's also like, why is it a world war? Why does it have to be such a, you know, why does it have to be a world war out of it? Like they fought so many little wars,
do more in grade 12 than in grade 10, where the focus is more Canadian. But yeah, I was definitely trying to sneak in as much world stuff as I could in grade 10. So for the distant causes, because there are so many and because they're so complex, I would give the students an acronym, LAINA, LAINA. Acronyms are really helpful for study purposes, for, you know, remembering and organizing the material that you've been exposed to. I beg your pardon. So the L in LAINA stands for life and ideas. The attitudes and the complexes that made Europeans more prepared to go to war. So we've talked about a number of these before, the scientific racism, the social Darwinism, just their belief that they were at the highest point of human progress
and
could do no wrong.
There's so much we can to talk about with that, right?
Which of course we will.
we sure will. So the socialism comes in there, and you know the reactions to socialism, and
there were quite a few ideas and aspects of life at the turn of the century that made a war seem unlikely, even impossible.
Yes, we're just going to keep progressing, like in this linear progress forever.
Or we're too civilized to go to war again. Or our economies are too interwoven and all of that stuff. So then the A in LAINA, the first one, is for the alliance system. One of the reasons it was a world war was these countries tied themselves to others. And when one went, the rest of their team went with them. Yeah. With exceptions, of course.
So this is an interesting one because, you know, all the stuff going on with NATO today, right?
And like, yes.
There's a whole thing of like, well, if Russia attacks Poland now, does that mean America has to defend Poland? Or like, and there's like these fine details of the law. Well, that's Article 5. That's not Article, you know, like the fine print of the alliance document, which says, you know, if it's a Tuesday. And
well, there's also the effect that the alliance has on those who aren't in it. So you yes. join an alliance and you see it as a defensive alliance.
Yes, of course, of course.
But somebody who's not in your club,
yeah.
it's a pretty obvious reaction to think, wait a second, that's aimed at me.
Yeah. And so you have a kind of intricate, I mean, this is also like a theme in because I always talk about your class, and then I also talk about the first year history class at the University of Toronto that I took, which was called like international relations or something, where the theme that the professor presented, I think his name was Professor Smith, and he would always pause the lecture at minute 40 and tell a joke. And I still remember some of the jokes, but he was obsessed with balance of power, you know, politics, right. which is a very British concept. And again, we'll talk about the concept and everything. But it's like the balance of power, which he talked about as like, as if it was, you know, like a foundational thing. I realize now it's like a very British Empire concept of we have to keep continental Europe divided so that we can go and do everything we like to do in the world. And, you know, when Germany caught on and Germany didn't like that, and Germany had the power to try to challenge that is when World War One happens. But the balance of power kind of blowing up in Britain's face is another element to this, right? Because Britain is making alliances to try to contain Germany, and Germany is making alliances to try to break out of the containment. And that's how we get, you know, that spark leading to everybody suddenly being at war with everybody because of these alliances.
Well, we're going to get to these alliances very early. In fact, yeah. Episode 2 of the series will be on the alliance system and how they contributed to the war.
Yeah.
The N in Lena is for nationalism, which I think I made clear in our first series is probably one of the more destructive of all the isms. You know, if you think of yeah. the ones you could choose from, nationalism is just about well, the most likely yeah. to bring you to a war.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, religion maybe close behind or
earlier in history, yes.
Very similar, right?
Yeah. Nationalism is the new religion, right?
Yeah,
exactly. The new intolerance. The I in Lena is for imperialism. Yeah. And a large part of that was the scramble for Africa and the Pacific. So we have covered a fair bit of that.
Yeah, we sure have. I think
we did leave out a couple of classic cases that are really directly connected to World War One. Morocco coming up, for example.
Well, yeah, and there are things like that where, you know, the Europeans inserted themselves also as like guardians of religion, right? So the British are like now the guardians of the Jews in the Ottoman Empire. The Russians are the guardians of the Orthodox in, you know, Ottoman Empire, and the French are guardians of Catholics in the Ottoman Empire. So then anything that happens in the Ottoman Empire to those communities is going to bring some kind of crisis, right?
And that's another thing for sure.
And that's a D. There's a D we could add, I think, which just occurred to me as you were talking, which is like the decline of various empires, you know, the British relative to the Germans and the US, the Ottoman Empire, which, you know, had a pretty good run, I'd say 600 years or whatever. and the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which is also, you know, been already kind of, you know, challenged by the rise of the German Empire.
Yeah, or you could throw in China as well.
Yeah, 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 of course.
Because with the end of the scramble for Africa and Persia. The Pacific, it looks like, hey, all of the properties are gone.
Yeah.
If we want a bigger empire, where's it going to come from? And they're looking at the Ottomans and they're looking at China and
And the Persian. So the decline, Delena, but the decline of some of these huge territorial empires, I think, has also, yeah. Dan, when I told Dan we were preparing for this, Dan Friedman Malloy, he read me another quote from W.E.B. Du Bois, where he was talking about, like, you know, a wolf, which was, you know, some different wolves that are, you know, happily eating the carcass of, you know, the rest of the world, but then also, you know, salivating and attacking each other over these same spoils, right?
Yeah.
So he had this very, very elaborated image of a pack of hungry wolves, which is the imperialist powers.
And the final A in Lena is for the arms race. The standing armies were enormous.
Yeah.
And there was also the sale of weapons and new weapons and bigger weapons. And of course, the famous naval race between the Germans and the British that eventually drove them about as far apart as you can get and contributed directly to the war.
Yeah. And this is the era of these different theories of naval empire, and, you know, we'll talk about that because there's all these theorists, geopolitical theorists, who talk about you know, the importance of controlling the coasts if you want to control the world. If you want, controlling the world is just, like, you know, an obvious thing that everybody just wants to do, right? There's a certain psychotic nature to this.
Well, that's the part of the ideas, right? The social Darwinistic ideas. If you're not dominating, then you are being dominated.
Yeah. So, there's lots to talk about in terms of the intellectual content of this. This
period. And in terms of organizing all of this information to present to students, will you repeat the story of what Cyrus said?
I have an almost 8-year old and a, you know, 4-year old. So the almost 8-year old, as I do research for this podcast, I'm frequently ranting and raving, you know, sharing quotes with my spouse. And so, you know, we have a philosophy where we try not to expose our kids to too much adult stuff, is, you know, there's a kind of an idea of filtering out the adult world from kids. But I guess he heard, me talking about World War One and causes of World War One. So one morning he just came up to me and he said, "Daddy, what were the causes of World War One?" And, you know, you can kind of quickly tell whether a kid is just, you know, trying to say some clever phrase they heard versus whether they're, like, really expecting an answer. And he seemed to really.
Later.
Yeah, he seemed to be really expecting an answer. So, you know, we watched this series, a very good cartoon series called Avatar, The Last Airbender, not to be confused with the movie, but the animated series is very good from Nickelodeon. And there's four nations. There's the Fire Nation, the Earth Kingdom, the Water Tribes, and the Air Nomads. And the whole premise is a big war where the Fire Nation has decided to try to take over the world, and they have more advanced industrial technology, and they, you know, the Earth Kingdom is the biggest, so they start taking parts of the Earth Kingdom. So I had that kind of framework where I said, okay, look, you know how the Fire Nation attacked and tried to take over the world? Well, you know, I tried to take it from there. And what I found when I was trying to give him a sense of why it turned into such a big war, the alliance system was, you know, really the key to explaining it to someone with no background, right? Where you say, you know, because Germany is allied with Austria and Turkey, and because England is allied with Russia and France, then when there was a problem between a Russian ally and an Austrian ally, then they started fighting each other, but then they had already said that they were going to fight. They were all going to fight if one of them fought, and then you ended up with a big war. So that's how you do it, in case any of you listeners have a kid who you need to explain World War One to. And hopefully by the time you're done this podcast, it'll this whole series, you'll have even more material.
Yeah. Yeah. And I also considered this material, not just from the perspective of teaching to high school students, but as a grad student myself. So if you are going to dive into this, if you are going to explore the causes of World War One in great detail, yeah, or God forbid, as a professional historian, you're going to run into a number of problems. The first of these great problems is the sheer quantity of information.
So would you, there are, you have six problems here, I see.
I do.
Okay. So number one, quantity.
Yeah. According to Christopher Clark, there is more written on the origins of World War One than you could possibly read in a lifetime. As of the year 2000, there were around 25,000 books and articles on the subject.
Okay.
And these include government documents, private diaries, journals, many of them unreliable, but still, newspapers. In 1900, Northwestern Europe was approaching 100% literacy. So people are reading books, they're reading newspapers. Okay, in many cases, trashy, but that impacts their attitudes and ideas for sure. You also
So there's like a pop culture thing happening. There's a propaganda happening. There's
public
all kinds
opinion
of
is
new
being
techniques.
Shaped by many of these things. You know, imagine doing a history of American politics at this time without watching Fox News.
Right, right.
But you also have new media, photographs, films, art, architecture, and all of this is in multiple languages,
right?
Not just English, obviously French and German, Russian, Italian, Hungarian, Serbo-Croatian. You could include Japanese. And how many of those languages do you speak or read fluently? So can you look at the original sources, or are you going to rely on secondary sources, you know, someone else's interpretation? So when I was briefly considering a PhD in modern history, my advisor said, well, learn German starting now.
And there were people, I mean, there were historians who did all the European, you know, who, you know, lots of your, you can find, like, I read a lot of Domenico Lasordo, who I think will come up more around World War II and interwar, but he, you know, he's that type of guy who, like, writes in, I think he's writing in Italian, but then he'll do a long quote in German, not translated. Like, he just assumes, you know. Yeah. And then he'll say, and then the French, you know, what the French prime minister said, and then it'll be a long French quote, untranslated, like, just, you know, everybody knows French, German, English, and Italian, obviously.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And there's another thing about that. You cannot simply learn conversational German.
No.
So right. I found
you
out
need
that
to read the memos.
Yeah. Like, there are dialects, of course, but there's two Germans at least, Hochdeutsch, High German. So it's what is taught in school.
Yeah.
But over 100 years ago, High German was much more formal. much more academic. And all of the German diplomatic documents were in this High German. So, you know, if you consider yourself fluent in German, you know, good luck with those documents. You're going to need to take a course in High German. I mean, in other languages, I don't know what to compare it to. I speak French. I can also speak Joual, you know, the Quebec slang. Yeah. But I have trouble listening to radio announcers or following a hockey game in French.
The languages I've studied all have that. Like Malayalam, you know, my parents speak Malayalam, so I speak some Malayalam, my grandparents. But they speak like super English. Like half the words are English. Okay. And I was making fun of my aunt, you know, just a couple of weeks ago, where I was like, you know, you don't speak Malayalam. And she was like, yes, I do. And I was like, talk to me in Malayalam. And she immediately, you know, within three words, she used an English word. She was like, she used the word translate. I was like, translate, eh? Translate is a Malayalam word. then she like searched, racked her brain for the Malayalam word for translate, which actually is the same as the Arabic word for translate. Tarjuma. So, yeah, Arabic has that. Farsi has that. We, you know, Kalida knows Farsi, obviously. But when we were in Afghanistan, you know, she would turn on the TV and we'd be watching the Tolo or whatever, and they'd be talking, and I'd be like, what are they saying? She was like, I have no idea what they're saying. Because that's like an elevated Farsi, right? Like school Farsi. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're going to get that problem in every language.
Yeah. Not English though, so much, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, you do.
You do?
Oh yeah. Think of the difference between I ain't gonna do that and an Oxford local. Don.
Right, local dialects and so on. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah.
So the second problem with approaching the causes of World War I is perspective. The closer you are to these events, it seems, the harder it is to see their relative importance. You know,
so a time perspective.
Well, also, like if you're right up against a tree, it's hard to see the whole forest. Mm-hmm. So you get these contemporary analysis that is just badly flawed.
Yeah.
Think of a modern crisis.
Sure.
And you have, well, you know,
China, Taiwan, whatever, Russia, Ukraine.
Yeah, watch CNN and, you know, realize just how wrong they've got it, right? Because they don't have enough perspective. So AJP Taylor gives the example of November 1917. A few months after the Russian Revolution had begun, he says, well-informed, intelligent people still thought that the Bolsheviks were just a few agitators and conspirators who had been paid by the Germans, and that they were
I've seen pro-Russia stuff that still thinks that.
yeah. So, but they're predicting that, you know, they're going to be swept away by the White Russians, especially if we give, you know, the anti-revolutionary forces, we give them weapons, and if necessary, we intervene. So the analysis is obviously pretty far off. And there are elements of wishful thinking that enter into
it. Yeah, no, yeah. So, you know, the reason I said, you know, there's the time perspective where the closer we are, you know, the more. But it's also the anything that has political resonances today is really hard to get an objective or a fair or balanced view on, right? So it's wishful thinking. It's like you trace your contemporary hatreds back to the past, and you know, I'm not even claiming that I'm exempt, right? Like I have a problem with imperialists, and you know, I'm always gonna see that, you know, the British imperialism, you know, angle first. And so, you know, there's just, this is history. This is what history is. And the closer we get to our contemporary time, the more you realize that history is reading you know, contemporary politics and moments back onto the past. And, you know, you're not supposed to do that as a scientific historian, but it's really, you know, it becomes more and more challenging the closer you get to today.
Yep. Yeah. Even in high school class, I would announce early on, often on the first day, I have biases. Everybody has biases. And yep. I will lie to you deliberately just to keep you on your toes. But, you know, you should also be prepared to, you know, look up things that I'm presenting or telling you and check them, yeah. You know? Yeah. So the third problem is in that neighborhood too. It's what Clark refers to as the World War of Documents. So after the war was over, at the Treaty of Versailles, there was a very famous clause in the treaty called the War Guilt Clause. The Germans knew about it. They knew it was coming. So they organized, like a good law team, they organized to argue their case that it wasn't our fault. So they came out with a little document package, 15,889 documents to refute the argument that Germany had started World War I. Now, the French are pushing for reparations, and the War Guilt Clause is pretty important to justify it. So yeah. They did the same thing. They put together a huge collection of documents to prove that Germany had started the war. And then you have Russia, where Lenin had a great time releasing the records of the Tsarist era to embarrass the previous Russian government and its allies, especially the British and French. So he published, you know, maps of the Ottoman Empire showing, you know, the carved up areas that were going to go to the different, you know, embarrassment galore. And he especially wanted to embarrass the French, who were demanding that the Bolshevik government repay the loans that France had given Russia before the war.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Good luck getting that money back. There's a paper, you know, I think I've mentioned it in our Scramble for Africa, but a listener, you know, sent this to me. It's called Delegitimating Empire, German and British Representations of Colonial Violence, 1918 and 19. So it's not just the World War of Documents. There's also like a whole bunch of, I guess a whole bunch of stuff we know about their conduct in the colonies because they're trying to embarrass each other as well. It's like all of a sudden the Germans have discovered how nasty the British were in Africa and vice versa.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the post-war settlement is we're going to take away Germany's colonies. And how can we justify that? Well, you guys are so mean.
Yeah. So right? There's the, I think I did talk about this, the British Blue Book.
Right.
Unfit colonial power, and then the German White Book, which says that violence and brutality is normal part of colonialism, which is a funny, I don't know if that's like, again, with Germany, they always seem to like offer defenses you don't necessarily want to be the cornerstone.
Yeah, it's the only one they had. You did it too. I know we did, but so did you.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not the greatest. There is a fourth problem with studying the causes of World War I. And that is reading the memoirs or you know, delving into the recollections of the key actors of the period, mostly men, mostly, you know, literate men who, like the World War of Documents, wanted to make the case that I didn't do anything wrong.
No.
Or it wasn't me.
It was the other guy.
Yeah. So these memoirs are just chock full of lies and omissions. If it's too embarrassing, just leave it out. So German Chancellor Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, his memoirs have almost nothing to say about July 1914, which is the crisis that the immediate causes that started the war. His counterpart in France, the president Raymond Poincaré, published a 10-volume memoir, which does not match the contemporary notes in his diaries, which were unpublished but not destroyed. So you're contradicting your contemporary memories and revising them, apparently. There was an American historian by the name of Bernadotte Schmidt. What a great name for an American. Bernadotte Schmidt, he traveled to Europe in the 1920s to interview many of these former political leaders, the key figures in the lead up to World War I. And they had one thing in common. He was struck by their complete lack of self-doubt. That's his line in quotations, complete lack of self-doubt. There was only one exception, and that was Lord Grey, the British foreign minister. Grey admitted to Schmidt that he had made a tactical error in July of 1914 by trying to negotiate with Vienna, Austria, through Berlin. And even Schmidt was struck by it. This is so English to stereotype wildly. It's fake humility. Everybody else says, no, I didn't make any mistakes at all. No, I was perfect. Everything was great. And Grey says, well, I made one small error.
All I did was trusting, you know, people who are not worthy of it. Or
yeah. I made a very small error, which, of course, didn't affect the outcome at all. But it does show my humility.
I mean, that problem, the unreliable memories, is definitely something that will remain salient from here on in, going all the way to decolonization. When I was researching the book on Rwanda and the Congo, the number of memoirs that omit important meetings and actions and transfers of weapons or whatever.
Yeah, or the memoir that says, you know, on the 7th of September, I didn't do much. Really? Yeah. Lunch with the president doesn't count?
Signing over the mineral rights to your entire country? For in perpetuity? You don't think that was something worth?
Yeah, you get a lot of that stuff where, you know, were you at that meeting? Yes. What was said? I don't remember.
But you remember, like, what everybody was wearing at the gala.
Yeah. Oh, man. In that vein, the fifth problem with, you know, researching the causes of World War One are the gaps. Believe it or not, with all the wealth of material, there are still missing documents. And there are key meetings that were unrecorded. So some things happened in camera and we don't know what was said. For example, the Franco-Russian summit in St. Petersburg, the 20th to the 23rd of June, 1914. So this is just less than a week before the assassination at Sarajevo. What were the French and Russians talking about? And we don't know. And of course, a lot of documents were lost in the Russian Revolution, but, you know, also in the war, there are some pretty key documents that have never been found. I don't know that one of them is like, you know, the magic bullet that would turn the history of World War One on its head. But, you know, and then you have people who were unusually secretive, like the Serbian Black Hand, the terrorist organization.
The anarchists, I see.
Well, they weren't anarchists. They were Serbian ultra-nationalists.
You mean the assassin of the Archduke was not an anarchist?
Not especially, no.
No, I didn't know that.
Ultra-nationalists. We'll do a little background on the Black Hand later.
Okay.
But one of their key leaders, Dragutin Dimitrijević, who was the head of Serbian military intelligence, well, he routinely burned his papers.
Right. Burn after reading.
Sometimes burn while reading.
Burn while reading.
Yeah. And the last of the big problems is something that it's hard to reconcile with today. It's the question of who was in charge. who was making the decisions, and we still don't really know who had the power.
Which is what leads to conspiracy theories, right?
Yeah. Well,
if you don't know, you have to speculate, and all speculation is going to end up as a conspiracy theory. Just which one, which is your favorite?
Well, or you get into really detailed studies of the characters involved. I mean, some of them are really crucial, but you end up with personalities like the Kaiser or the Tsar, who changed their minds frequently, who acted as though they were in complete control, but weren't. Was it the chancellors, the foreign ministers, the generals? You know, you can make an argument, and the politicians often do, that, oh, we were overruled by the army. And the roles were very, very different. In Canada, we don't expect much from our cabinet ministers because basically the prime minister holds pretty absolute power over them, can dismiss them without a thought. So we get, you know, people who just basically say yes to the prime minister. Well, back in 1914 or 1900, foreign ministers were pretty independent of prime ministers. Very often the king or the emperor or the prime minister would simply say, go do your stuff. And
yeah,
and
because it was an aristocratic system, right? So these foreign ministers were also powerful noblemen in their own right, right?
Yep. And you don't have immediate communication. Yeah, you have the telegraph and so on. But the role of ambassador in 1914, completely different. Right. You want somebody with diplomatic skills. Very often they were policymakers in their own right. Yeah. You know, now it's kind of some kind of patronage game. You reward your supporters by making them ambassador to wherever.
Somewhere nice.
Yeah. But they don't make policy.
Yeah.
They're just doing public relations.
And it's also, yeah, like you don't, these are the kinds of things you don't want to read back, because you're just a political appointee today, but back then it's like you're a member of one of these big families, right? Like
every
country is run by, like the British is run by the aristocracy.
Some of these ambassadors have enormous influence in the countries that they're stationed.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, that's still true of the American ambassadors in most of the world, but
I suppose. Yeah. And finally, Christopher Clark talks about the blame game. So as you say, this problem that we don't really know everything, it means that if you want to do your conspiracy theory, or if you want to accuse a particular country of being responsible for World War I, you can find material to build your case. In fact, you can support just about any point of view. There are enough documents out there, and there's enough wiggle room that you can create just about any case you want.
Yeah.
Well, so a bit of a minefield.
A bit of a minefield. So, you know, from a kind of a communist or anti-colonial perspective, World War I leads directly to the Russian Revolution. It leads, you know, it sort of saves China from being partitioned, because that was very much on the table just before World War I started. A lot of I've heard, you know, Chinese friends say, like, we were basically saved from final partition by World War I. So
really, because it didn't save them from Japan.
No, but being carved up like Scramble for Africa style
the Ottoman Empire. Yeah, I suppose
would have been worse, right? They would have spent a century trying to get back together, trying to reassemble the country, because it would have been all these different regions. I mean, yeah, the Arab world is exactly in that position, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a big deal. It's a big deal for us as well, politically, you know, if you're here for the politics, you know, I guess I probably don't have to try that hard to make a case that we should know about World War One. But how are we gonna? We have these six problems.
Yeah, so we're taking a very different approach from the first two series. Rather than go thematic, as in the first, or in a sort of geographic, you describe our scramble approach?
Tour? Our tourism?
Yeah. our approach method? To the causes will be semi-chronological.
Yeah.
We're going to try to approach it that way. But of course, we're going to include quite a bit of material that you wouldn't often find, say, in a course on the origins of World War One, things that we believe should be there, and things we just can't resist including.
And at first I thought we should just do those, but I think you know, it's fair to say you convinced me that we also have to do all the mainstream stuff too. We have to make sure we cover all the things that would otherwise be covered.
Because as you say, it's still political and relevant and important to what comes after.
So yeah, one-stop shop, causes of World War One. Stay tuned for the next, half year or so? If you want to skip this, just spend the next half year, spend the fall listening to back episodes of Civilizations, and then come back, in the winter when we maybe start, we'll be starting World War One. Okay.